At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. One court ruled the Stormy Daniels hush money trial will start on time. Another gave Trump another 10 days and lowered his bond to $175 million. And neither of these is the lead Trump story, because the lead Trump story is Trump is nuts. He has now compared himself to Jesus. No, Christ. Jesus Christ. Received this morning, beautiful thank you. He posted at 10:30 Eastern Dementia Time. It's ironic that Christ walked through his greatest persecution the very week they are trying to steal your property from you. But have you seen this verse? Then whoever sent this to him sent him Psalm 109, 3-8, adapted for biblical purposes of election denial. And finally, I'm praying this over you daily. So many are praying for you. Thank you again for taking the arrows intended for us. He compared himself to Christ. And I always thought he would go first with Napoleon. No, Bonaparte. Not Napoleon Dynamite. Bonaparte. And then, in front of the microphones, outside the courtroom, one of his courtrooms, he also had another sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head, you know, just a little funny.
You can't have an election in the middle of a political season. We just had Super Tuesday, and we had a Tuesday after a Tuesday already.
No, we never have elections in the middle of a political season. We always have them in the middle of wabbit season. Duck season, wabbit season.
You're muttering, boy. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
And it's not just that the fluent aphasia or phonemic paraphasias or whatever abruptly killed off another million Trumpian brain cells while he was live on all networks had a field day yesterday. Trump, the cornered animal, also screwed up strategically. Just as last week, the world's leading legal authority on parking lot law missed the chance to deny that Trump would ever sell something to a foreign government or foreign gangsters or Vladimir Putin for the money needed in the business fraud case. Now Trump has done exactly the same thing. Produced an unusually cogent word salad when the one and only correct answer to this next question is, quote, no, unquote.
Money from a foreign government to pay the bond or their fines or...
No, I don't do that. I think you'd be allowed to, possibly. I don't know. I mean, if you go borrow from a big bank, many of the banks are outside of this. As you know, the biggest banks, frankly, are outside of our country.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the $16,131,559,784 rubles I need. Anyway, Trump clearly had another episode or episodes And the additional evidence was another social media post, weird even for him, there should be no fine. He wrote at 7:54 Eastern Dementia Time, long before the bond was reduced, did nothing wrong. Why should I be forced to sell my, quote marks, babies, end quote marks, because, etc. So, Trump sells babies, he says. That's another good look. If Trump is to be believed, he has more than enough money to pay a bond of $11 billion, but won't, and would have to sell babies to get the money and avoid having his assets seized. And I happily quote my high school friend Will Bunch, noting, "We worry so much about Biden's health, and yet Trump is the one experiencing seizures." The legalities were overshadowed by the timeless words, "You can't have an election in the middle of a political season." But in the parlance of baseball spring training, Trump and his lawyers played a split squad schedule yesterday, and nominally they got one loss and one win, but I'm not exactly seeing how the win is actually a win. The loss is obvious. The Stormy Daniels hush money election influence trial, 34 felonies in all, but probably no jail time, will start as scheduled 3 weeks from yesterday, April 15th. This supposed win? Well, a grace period for paying the $454 million he owes is extended by the appeals court by 10 days until a week from Thursday, and the bond is reduced to $175 million. Now, how is this a win? If Eric Trump, moron twin number two, spent the weekend literally screaming at cameras that, quote, "A $10 million bond is a large bond, a $15 million bond is an enormous bond." So bond being reduced from $500 million to $175 million would seem like a token adjustment under Statute 39B, subsection 3, make rich people feel better. Eric Trump also explained that every single person, when I came to them saying, "Can I get a $500 million bond?" they were laughing. They were laughing, unquote. That might have a different explanation, Sonny. I mean, have you ever met yourself? If, meanwhile, you were hoping Aaron Rodgers would be Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s choice for vice president on his Trump stalking horse campaign, and thus the pair of them would immediately tear their Achilles tendons and be forced to miss the entire 2024 NFL season, that's the NFL, National Fruitcake League, bad news. He was expected to announce his vice president on Tuesday, and it's Nicole Shanahan. Nicole Shanahan, jeez. She has superior credentials. She paid for most of Kennedy's disastrous ripoff of his uncle's 1960 presidential commercial. And she was married to Google co-founder Sergey Brin and then allegedly slept with Musk. And then she demanded a $1 billion divorce settlement. We don't know how much she got. But if you are bargaining down from a buy it now price of $1 billion, you're doing just fine. And here is my bankroll, my vice president. They were to announce this at 2 p.m. Eastern in Oakland, California, at the Henry J. Kaiser Center for the Arts. Henry J. Kaiser, the aluminum guy and philanthropist, who also made cars for a while, one of which he named the Henry J. And he wanted to introduce steam-powered automobiles in the 1950s. So it's all going well for Bobby Jr., except for this small detail, the news that he had 15,000 signatures, enough to qualify for the presidential ballot in Nevada? Not so much. CBS News reporting Kennedy apparently overlooked the proviso in the law in Nevada requiring that to be valid, the ballot petitions of any independent candidate must list a president and a vice president. And obviously none of them filed before today could have done that. So technically the number of petition signatures Kennedy has in Nevada is approximately, none. Kennedy will have until August to again reach the 15,000 threshold if he can only find somebody to pay for printing the new petitions and the cost of canvassing the state and... All right. Mrs. X Google will be able to help you there. And now to the latest on the NBC Ronna Romney McDaniel fluster cluck. No, she has not been spit-canned. No, the people who hired her have also not been spit-canned. Yet. First, if you think you read somewhere that the serial liar and confessed organizer for the Trump fake electors scheme, who changed her name because Trump insisted, but she was only being a team player, a good soldier, she was only following orders, McDaniel, would be appearing only on NBC News and not MSNBC. That was the headline everywhere over the weekend, like just NBC News and not MSNBC was somehow better. Turns out that's not true. MSNBC's president, Rashida Jones, identified by Politico as one of the NBC News apparatchiks who unanimously supported the hiring of Ronna McDaniel, reportedly reassured cable staffers that McDaniel would not appear on MSNBC. But the Washington Post, Deadline, the Wall Street Journal, Semaphore News, and now Politico, basically everybody but the International Stamp Gazette, are all reporting that that is not what Rashida Jones said, that she responded to her angry staff, only that there was no expectation that McDaniel would ever be on MSNBC. Separately, she told MSNBC talent and executives they were welcome to book McDaniel as a pundit, a guest, or whatever. Andrea Mitchell. Second, if you read somewhere about Chuck Todd's principled and even self-endangering stance against and apology for the foisting of one of Trump's top 10 all-paid-to-lie shills on television news viewers, two caveats. I'm actually going to say this. I commend Chuck Todd for going on Meet the Press and commencing his remarks by savaging McDaniel and saying, quote, "I don't know what to believe. I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract." That was ballsy and journalistic, but it wasn't that ballsy or that journalistic. Chuck Todd did say, "Our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation." But he was looking at the Meet the Press host, Kristen allegedly Welker, when he said that. He was not looking at the camera, not looking at the public. Chuck was mad because the next future ex-host of Meet the Press had been hung out to dry. She had been told that McDaniel would be a guest on Sunday, not a paid contributor. He was angry about that. He did not say anything about being angry because NBC had hired somebody who tried to undo an election and put them in front of the public as some sort of analyst or neutral observer or who knows what. He wasn't even angry because just 10 months ago, Ronna tweeted, quote, "MSNBC's primetime propagandists wasted countless hours pushing the Russia collusion hoax. Last night, they discussed Durham's report for barely 10 minutes, in which they insisted the weaponization of government found in the report was no big deal." Chuck Todd went back into the fray again last night on Twitter and again missed the point. Quote, "This is about whether honest journalists are supposed to lend their credibility to someone who intentionally tried to ruin ours," unquote. While that is certainly a component, it remains incidental. Ronna McDaniel did not just try to make life tough for Chuck Todd or for other journalists. She tried to help install an unelected dictator in the United States of America and do heavens know what to the elected, usurped president, a man named Joe Biden. The other caveat about Chuck Todd is this. He signed a 2-year contract extension with NBC News in July or August of 2022. They made a big deal about it. It was in all the papers. Of course they made a big deal about it. He had yet to be fired as the host of Meet the Press. There has not been word one since, though, about any further contracts, which leads to the inevitable mathematical conclusion that Chuck Todd is now lame duck Todd. He risked something by saying what he did, but that something looks like maybe, at maximum, 9 months of a paycheck. Similarly, Joe Scarborough went out on a leaf yesterday morning. He and the latest Mrs. Joe accurately called McDaniel, quote, "an anti-democracy election denier," adding, "we hope NBC will reconsider its decision." Trust me on this. Joe Scarborough used far stronger language trying to get me fired at NBC in public than he did about Ronna McDaniel. And I used far stronger language trying to get him fired in public. I'll go into that and the surprisingly long history of news talent daring management to fire them at 30 Rock at length at the end of this podcast. For now, though, let us salute Joe Scarborough, proudly defying his masters and becoming the 6,397th person to storm the Bastille. Of course, back there behind even Joey Scars at 6,398 or later is Rachel Maddow. With her clout, with NBC's terrified and unfathomable conviction that she is all that stands between them and MSNBC evaporating overnight, she should and could have said something. She could have said anything last Friday when her employers stabbed her credibility and the credibility of her network in the back. But her ship on this had sailed. Her ship on this, in fact, had sunk on March 5th. It was Maddow who had proudly and justifiably proudly announced that her network would no longer take Trump's speeches live. And then, on Super Tuesday, MSNBC carried Trump's speech live. Rachel solemnly announced that, quote, allowing somebody to knowingly lie on your air was irresponsible. And then she stayed on the air anyway, because the correct thing to do when your editorial bosses shit all over you and revoke your say in what your program looks like live on the air on your program, the correct thing to do is to stand up and say, I'll be back when MSNBC returns to the agreed upon journalistically correct policy of not showing Trump live. Instead, she in effect said, I'll be back after this message from Ozempic. No wonder they hired Ronna McDaniel, who was going to protest, not Maddow. Then there's Kristen Welker herself. Her protest consisted of bravely insisting to viewers that she had nothing to do with the hiring of Ronna McDaniel. She might as well have called herself what McDaniel did, called herself a team player. This was cowardice in action, buck passing. You want clean hands in this situation? Then you should have refused to go on the air with her. I know of at least four occasions at NBC and MSNBC when news people refused to go on the air with somebody to whom they objected. Again, details later. Maddow did it. I did it. Getting no applause while Todd and Scarborough and Welker bask in the afterglow of having run the gamut of protest emotions from A to B is an NBC reporter named Brandi Zadrozny. She tweeted, so many talented reporters laid off this year, workers who provided the content, won the awards, built the credibility of their shops, and worked for a yearly salary at a fraction of what big-name contributors get in fancy contracts to fill pundit boxes on TV, unquote. Ronna McDaniel's name is carefully excluded from her text, but not from her point. Separately, Zadrozny wrote, reporters have no control over the opinion or pundit section. Not coincidentally, Brandi Zadrozny, who deserves the applause, is the specialist at NBC News covering political radicalization, extremism, and disinformation on the internet. In other words, the Ronna McDaniels of this world are her meat. Her postscript there about reporters having no control over the McDaniel situation was not gratuitous. A prominent PR person and former Obama advisor wrote, reporters decry the demonization of the press and then offer the demonizer a $300,000 retainer. Let me assure you, nobody involved in the hiring of Ronna McDaniel by NBC News was a reporter. The four people on the hot seat at the moment for this disaster at NBC, the four people most likely to get fired, Carrie Budoff-Brown and Rebecca Blumenstein, they did reporting last more than a decade ago. Rashida Jones, president of MSNBC, she last did any in college in 2002. The chairman of NBC News, the chairman, Cesar Conde, has never been a reporter or an editor or a producer, but he is on a lot of boards of directors. Conde will likely survive this, though if he leaves NBC and Comcast in the next few years, this will have been why. Budoff Brown, NBC senior vice president in charge of politics, and Blumenstein, the president in charge of Meet the Press, are in more imminent danger. As Politico put it, the idea of bringing the Trump flunky into NBC News began with negotiations for NBC to cover one of the Republican debates. Quoting, "Through that process, McDaniel built a good rapport with Budoff Brown and Blumenstein. McDaniel left the RNC, signed on with the CAA talent agency, and went looking for a TV contract. While McDaniel had talks with other networks, she was trying to avoid working for CNN but had serious discussions with ABC, NBC always had the inside track. Quote, Rana had a good experience with Carrie and Rebecca and felt more comfortable than with some of the other networks, a person close to McDaniel said, unquote. Not good, Carrie and Rebecca. After the last big disaster at NBC News, the Brian Williams, I captured Saddam fiasco, NBC slowly eased out its news president, Deborah Turness, eased out her boss, the Comcast president of all the company's news presidents, Pat Philly. And of course, they tried to fire Brian Williams only to discover that in his contract there was a poison pill that meant if they fired him, they owed him more than if they did not fire him. Anyway, that's the future. The present? Stuff is still falling out of the sky on everybody at NBC News and MSNBC. Somebody on Fox News yesterday asked what the difference was between NBC hiring Ronna McDaniel and Fox hiring a liberal guest commentator named Jessica Tarlov. An intelligent, conservative friend of mine for more than three decades sincerely and calmly asked me to explain the difference between Ronna on NBC and Donna on ABC, Donna Brazile. Well, the points are Jessica Tarlov's role in the Democratic Party topped off at she used to work for consultant Doug Schoen. Doug Schoen was kind of a Democrat, I guess. And while Donna Brazile was twice acting chair of the Democratic National Committee, kind of a match, you know, she never did stand idly by while her president tried to foment a revolution against the government, and she didn't participate in one of his coup attempts. Neither Tarlov nor Brazile, for that matter, nor anybody else, has ever said, quote, in November 2020, there were concerns everywhere. Imagine, you saw it, videos being put out, all types of things. You have to track that down. So where I was in 2020, and the quotes are that being taken from a very long time ago, 3.5 years ago, to where I am today, you've got to allow the process to play out. And I think it is fair to say, I think there were concerns then. That's what Ronna McDaniel said about sowing conspiracy theories about an illegitimate election. It's what she's still saying, still insisting there was reason to question or challenge or undermine or reply with blood to the 2020 election. She's still saying it. She said that Sunday. That quote was from Sunday. That quote was from her NBC debut on Meet the Press. She is still an election denier, and damn her to hell for it. More cynically, Tarlov and Brazile have some, and this is the way television executives think. Television news executives are dealing with a brand. Television news executives think this way. Tarlov and Brazile have some television value. Ronna McDaniel starts with the whole, you know, insurrectionist adjacent thing, and then she goes downhill from there. She is hated by every Democrat and liberal and loyal American. Meanwhile, Trump just got her fired as head of the Republican National Committee. And any MAGA cultists who had not already blamed her for the losses in 2018 and 2020 and 2022, they're blaming her now. She brings her new employer no access inside the MAGA world. She's just been thrown out of what was left of the Republican world. And oh, by the way, she's terrible on television. Yet ultimately, the problem is this. People paid big salaries to make essential decisions about the coverage of an election that will decide whether or not we still have a democracy next January. They thought she was a great hire. And nice as the protests from Todd and Welker and, golly, I hope they reconsider Scarborough were, bluntly, the moment the hiring of Ronna Romney McDaniel was announced, MSNBC anchors and producers and writers and NBC News anchors and producers and writers should have literally walked off that job right then, gone on strike. Because it all comes down to this. The hiring of Ronna McDaniel did not represent some kind of attempt gone crazy wrong for political balance, the way hiring her uncle Mitt might. The hiring of Ronna McDaniel stipulated that on American television news, there can be some kind of balance, some kind of equation, some kind of yes, but some kind of both sidesism between the reality of the 2020 election and election deniers and the Trumpist cult and the people who wanted to kill Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence. Ronna McDaniel is the flat earthers. Ronna McDaniel is the climate change deniers. Ronna McDaniel might as well be Q from QAnon. This is an example of reality trying to appease hallucination and conspiracy theory and mental illness in hopes of making more money off its newscasts. Ronna Romney McDaniel's presence as an NBC News employee legitimizes the election deniers and the conspiracy theorists and Trump. It is an act of journalistic self-defenestration and, for the future of democracy in this country, an act of self-immolation. Until NBC News fires Ronna McDaniel and all those responsible for her, it and MSNBC and CNBC and all the local NBC stations and every other NBC Comcast Universal property, they all can no longer be considered part of an actual news organization. Also of interest here, as promised, the full story of all the times I know about when NBC and MSNBC talent stood up to management and said, if you do this, I'm out, or I'm going public, or other risky things that nobody said or did about the hiring of Ronna McDaniel. And it's not just about me. It takes a little while to tell the whole story, but only like 27 minutes. But first, on this all-new edition of Countdown, Shohei Ohtani addresses the media, but it's not what he said, it's what he didn't say that just made the baseball gambling scandal way worse. And now, surprise, surprise, there's another sports gambling scandal in basketball. This is about the three-pointer that never was.
From way downtown, doubts that overhang. That's next. This is Countdown.
So the best way to get what you need is to be prepared and to do it early, like World Series tickets. My dad had the foolproof plan for getting us World Series tickets behind the home dugout in 1976, 77, 78. He bought season tickets in the Bronx in 1972. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you're hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/countdown. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology hits the front row to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/countdown to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/countdown. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Terminix. Terminix can't help you run for office or take on the country's biggest problems, but they can help you solve one of the peskiest problems at home, pests. You know, the ants in your kitchen, the roaches under your sink, even the termites in the walls. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. No matter what type of pest it is, they can Terminix it fast with personalized pest care that puts you in control. Their expertly trained technicians may not know intricate political strategy, but they know their local pest pressures. And with customized plans tailored to your specific situation, you get everything you need to not just get pests out, but keep them out for good. Between their speedy service, caring technicians, and over 95 years of experience, it's no mystery why they're trusted by homes and businesses everywhere. So if you have a pest problem, don't stress it, Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com to book online today.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Olbermann.
This is SportsCenter. Wait, check that. Not anymore. This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
In sports, Dateline Los Angeles. One assumes Shohei Ohtani's people think they made the scandal involving his former interpreter and friend, and maybe involving him, Shohei Ohtani, that they made it go away yesterday by having the $700 million Dodger read a statement to the media yesterday and then not take any questions. But it did not go away because those questions did not go away. The explanation was very simple. Ohtani says he never bet on baseball or any sports. He never asked anybody to bet on his behalf. He never went to a bookie. He says his now-fired interpreter and friend Ippei Mizuhara stole all the money from him, that Mizuhara ran up the massive illegal gambling debts himself, at least $4.5 million, and also that Mizuhara never told Ohtani that the story had begun to leak out. Ohtani implied that the interpreter went to Ohtani's spokespeople last week and lied to them, too, by telling them Ohtani was covering for a friend in trouble and paying his debts, and that Ohtani wanted him to have his handlers let Mizuhara tell the story in an interview with ESPN. Ohtani says Mizuhara never asked him for permission to talk to his people, never asked him for permission to do the interview, and that the spokespeople never double-checked with Ohtani that Mizuhara was not making it all up, which is exactly what Ohtani says happened. Ohtani insists that the first time he heard anything about Mizuhara gambling or about him, Ohtani, paying the debts was when Mizuhara addressed the Dodger team after a game last week in South Korea to warn them that the story was about to break. This is all plausible. This is all believable. This has all happened before. Employees, even trusted ones, do rip off their employers, even their friends, even their relatives, all the time, even for millions. And mix this part in. If you are somebody's translator, it would be all that much easier to get away with it. But Shohei Ohtani never addressed, didn't take questions about, one pivotal detail. If he did not know Mizuhara gambled, if he did not know Mizuhara owed a bookie $4.5 million or more, if he did not know Mizuhara owed somebody that amount of money, how did the money get wired from Shohei Ohtani's bank account into the bank account of the bookie? At no point in his statement did Ohtani even imply that he had, foolishly, given Mizuhara access to his accounts, or even that Mizuhara had somehow improperly gained access to his accounts. As long as questions about that remain unanswered, the story remains alive. Dateline Toronto, I said to a friend yesterday that the over-under on an actual sports gambling game-fixing scandal after the Ohtani stuff was now 6 months. I was off by 5 months, 30 days, and about 22 hours. ESPN quotes sources who say the National Basketball Association is investigating a fringe player named Jonte Porter of the Toronto Raptors. On January 26th, DraftKings, the official betting something of the NBA, had reported increased interest from its bettors on what are called prop bets involving Jonte Porter, combination bets based on his statistics in the game that night. And that night, the over-unders for Porter's stats were set at 5.5 points, 4.5 rebounds, 1.5 assists, and 0.5 of a 3-point shot. But Porter played only 4 minutes in that game and then left the game, and the team said he had re-aggravated a previous eye injury. Ultimately, he scored no points. He had only 3 rebounds, only 1 assist, no 3-pointers. In other words, if you bet the under on all of his stats in a prop bet on Jonte Porter, you won a bundle. DraftKings said it was, in fact, the biggest money winner for bettors of any NBA player props from games that night. And then, last week, March 21st, DraftKings Sportsbooks reported that prop bets involving Porter produced the number one moneymaker the previous night in basketball betting. In the game that night, Porter scored no points. He attempted only 1 shot. He got 2 rebounds. He played only 3 minutes because he left the game early because of what the team said was an illness. Porter did not play in Toronto's game Saturday night, personal reasons. He did not play in Toronto's game last night, personal reasons. It is a huge mess. From this angle, it looks like a bottomless pit. It's not game fixing per se, but what it looks like is like a cousin of what they used to call point shaving. Point shaving was deliberately missing shots to keep a game close in order to beat the expectations of odds makers. Point shaving nearly destroyed college basketball in the 1950s and again in the late 70s and early 80s. And no, sorry. You cannot bet on whether or not they ban Jonte Porter for a season, for life, or not at all. At least, you can't bet on it legally. I think you can't. Postscripts to the news. Some headlines, some updates, some snark, some predictions, and in this edition, a lot of sadness. Dateline Central Park in New York. The worst of our fears here has come true. Flacco, the Eurasian owl who escaped or was freed from his enclosure in the zoo here in February 2023 and who died after a collision with a Manhattan building on February 24th of this year, had residue of 4 different rat poisons in his system when he died and a virus contracted from eating infected pigeons. To reduce the post-mortem report from Central Park to its essentials, the rat poison and the disease, quote, would have been debilitating and ultimately fatal even without a traumatic injury and may have predisposed him to flying into or falling from the building. His admirers, and this city was and is filled with them, wondered why his wonderful nighttime hooting had stopped several days before he met his end. They suspect now it was because he was so sick. There's no evidence this was deliberate. It was, however, what experts worried about the day he got out of the zoo, that he could get sick, eating the rodent life around here, and that the city was also full of poisons out in the open intended for rodents or already in rodents. I'm not going to wax poetic about this striking huge owl with his eerie glowing orange eyes, but there was something transcendent about him living a year free in the neighborhood and yet choosing always to stay nearby the humans he had gotten used to in captivity. He spent time all around this city. He spent evenings as far away as 60 blocks south of the park, and then he came back. And he settled in the park's northern reaches, enjoying this place, just as the humans did. They may build a statue to him. I hope they do. It will be nice to remember him. But it was much nicer each night knowing he was out there. Dateline Franklin, North Carolina. This news probably will not mean much to you, but Bill Jorgensen has died. It will not mean much to you unless you know every second of the movie The King of Comedy by heart, or unless you used to watch this.
It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
The tragedy on 28th Street with nine dead. Nixon talks about the dumping of Spiro Agnew. Many lives still on the line in Holland tonight. And for the gossips, Jackie's German prince. I'm Bill Jorgensen. This is the 10 o'clock news.
That was who anchored the newscast on which I was an intern when I was 19 years old. And you can probably understand my uncertainty that I had the skills or the voice or the shock of white hair to last, say, 1 hour in the business. Thankfully, they did not all sound like Bill Jorgensen. He was a news anchorman in Columbus, Ohio in the 50s, Cleveland starting in 1961, and New York from 1967 through 1983. He pioneered the concept of the 10 o'clock news here when all the other stations had network dramas on or reruns. The newscast aimed to tell you everything that happened that day in 1 hour. Seriously, everything. This was made more plausible by the fact that Bill Jorgensen kinda sounded like God. He did not suffer fools gladly, and he thought all television executives were fools. I'd like to say I got that from him, but I doubt it. By 1978, year 12 for him in New York, he had pretty much run out of patience with the executives at Channel 5, and he was beginning to lash out. And everybody agreed a month or two off would be a good idea. So he bought a Winnebago, and he and the wife took off to see America on a sabbatical. They left about a week or 10 days before my internship at Channel 5 started. My story with Bill Jorgensen can be summarized in 4 phone calls. My first week at the news assignment desk, the phone rings. I have a collect call for anyone from Kansas City, Missouri, from Bill Jorgensen. Will you accept the charges? Impulsively, I made an executive decision. We will, operator. The next voice seemed to be coming not from the phone, not from Kansas City, but from some sort of PA system vibrating above the city from way above my head.
This is Jorgensen. Get me Monsky, please.
Monsky. Mark Monsky. Or as it said in the credits to our newscast, Mark B.V.S. Monsky, director of news. Mark B. Von Summer Monsky, the boss. The news director. The bad news was Mark B. Von Summer Monsky carried a gun. The good news was he liked me. I told his secretary. His secretary handled the call, got Monsky. 3 minutes later, Monsky came out and said to all of us at the desk, me included, "For God's sake, Jorgensen just called from Kansas City. They were having breakfast at the International House of Pancakes. They come out, he and the wife, to the parking lot, and somebody has stolen the Winnebago. We got to get them out of there. They have nothing. Wire them some cash or something." Hereupon, the news director reached into his pocket and grabbed a stack of bills. "Here's $500. The sabbatical had not started all that well. On the other hand, only once before in my life had I seen $500 in cash. The sabbatical had been noticed, however. We interns were given instructions on what to do when we got phone calls like, well, like phone call number 2.
"What happened to Bill Jorgensen?" asked the woman who said she was from Booton, New Jersey.
He's on assignment, ma'am, I said. We expect him back in, I believe, 2 weeks, perhaps sooner. She laughed at me.
Yeah, sabbatical. like you bastards, assigned George Sharman to a sabbatical. There had been three primary anchors of the Channel 5 10 o'clock news: Jorgensen, his deputy, George Sharman, who also had a shock of white hair, and their deputy, Bill McCreary. And then one day, George Sharman was gone, and a new kid from California had replaced him. They did this to the assignment desk one weekend as well. I was interning for Steve, the assignment editor, on Friday, and said goodbye and have a nice weekend to him, and he said the same to me. And then on Monday, I was working for Joe, the new assignment editor. I said to my first mentor at Channel 5, a researcher named Stanley Pinsley, as quick as death. And Stanley paused, and he congratulated me. You figured out the entire news business, and you're only 19. Bill Jorgensen came back to the newsroom soon after. I had not known him before. I didn't really know him now. He came out of his office only occasionally. Might as well have worn a hood over his head. No eye contact. He ducked out a side door. One night that they didn't fire the assignment editors, so at 9:45 we all sat back and prepared to finally exhale after a crazy day and watch the actual newscast in progress. And now comes phone call number three. Channel 5 News.
This is Jorgensen. Who's this?
I thought quickly. I'm an intern. You wouldn't know me. He thought quickly.
Fair enough. Tell Gary Kay and Chaffee and Jay. Tell them the elevator to the studio is stuck. Use the stairs. Goodbye.
I did as told. I went back to producer's row. Hey, Bill just called to tell you the elevator to the studio is stuck, so use the stairs. Jay, who I believe was the director that night, looked up optimistically. Is he on it? When I shook my head no, the look of disappointment verging on tears on Jay's face remains to this day indescribable. Towards the end of my internship, things went south with Bill Jorgensen, and he took another sabbatical. Now the newscast was anchored by the kid from California, whose name was John Rowland, and Bill McCreary. And they were great to me, as was Bill Mazur, the sportscaster for whom I interned half the time. They were all great to me. My friend Stanley Pinsley was, the writer Bobby Campbell, all of them. Bill McCreary also did the sports on Fridays. And one Friday, he and Bill Mazur were going to both be off, and their backup was too. And they and the sports producer Cliff Gelb decided I should do the sportscast. And they were serious. Mark BVS Monsky told them, no, you're not serious. Even he said, soon enough, kid, you'll do it soon enough. I went back to Cornell for my senior year, and I realized our newscasts, which were unsurpassed for a college radio station, were running at about 9 miles an hour, while Bill Jorgensen's 10 o'clock news was doing 100, 120, sometimes 250 miles an hour. I thought to myself, you're going to have to step it up a little. Anyway, one night the next March, there's a ring in my apartment at 207 Delaware Avenue, Ithaca, New York, and it's a phone call number four, and it's my friend Stanley Pinsley calling from Channel 5. And I'm going to emphasize, this is what he told me in 1979. It was only later confirmed for me by one other source, so who knows? Oh, you missed it, bubby, Stanley said. Jorgensen's back. Well, he was back. He comes in, he does a week, he's shaky as hell. Monsky and the general manager take him to lunch. They tell him, we're letting you go. And he's like, okay with it. He's very calm. He has a little meeting with the senior staff, and he thanks everybody. And he apologizes, and everybody goes, hey, it's great. But you know, he just wasn't right, even for him. So today, evidently, before I got in, he's got a little practical joke to play on everybody. And from what he said as they took him out of the building, he thought this would show everybody he was handling his firing okay. So I guess about 5, he comes out of his office carrying this big box. And on each side of the box, it's got one word stenciled on it. Dynamite. And he stands by producer's row, and he says, if I have to go, I'm taking all yous with me. And the box doesn't look real, but who knows with Jorgensen. So Chaffee hits him high, and Gary Kay hits him low, and Jay grabs the box as it falls. And that's the last we've seen of Jorgensen. I understand he's resting somewhere. I'm sorry you missed it. On March 14th, 1979, Channel 5 in New York announced that Bill Jorgensen had resigned. and his lawyer told the New York Times he had quit to go do something better. And I just assumed, well, even as crazy as I found television news in my slice of my internship, that would be the end of him. And then, on April 6th, Stanley calls me again. Bobby, guess who's the new anchor guy at Channel 11? Jorgensen! What a business! You sure you want those job referrals? He started on the Channel 11 news at 10 on April 23rd, 1979. He'd barely been off the air 1 month. He lasted 4 years. He was 96 when he died, according to his daughter, on March 13th. Nobody noted this, but March 13th, was the 57th anniversary of the first edition of Channel 5's 10 o'clock news with Bill Jorgensen. Even his obituary in the New York Times said, quote, Mr. Jorgensen struggled with station management. Clearly, he did not struggle enough, however, to outweigh his skill and his drive and his brilliance and his dedication to journalism and his voice, and especially his sign-off. He was, now that I think of it, the last newscaster I knew who had his own sign-off.
There's our report for tonight. Bill Jorgensen for Channel 5 News. Thanking you for your time this time. Until next time.
On this all-new edition of Countdown, things I promised not to tell. The damnedest thing about this Ronna McDaniel story at NBC News. Where are all the people threatening to quit? Hell, Maddow once threatened to quit over something. I threatened to quit twice. At least, that I remember. Joe Scarborough blackmailed his bosses twice. Hayes refused to go on one night. And then there was the time John McCain bullied NBC News into offing me. And was helped by Tom Brokaw. A lot of things I promised not to tell in the wake of Help Me, Ronna, coming up. First, still more idiots to talk about. The daily roundup of the miscreants, morons, and Dunning-Kruger effect specimens who constitute today's worst persons in the world. First, the bronze, worse, Reese Davis. One of the nicest guys in sportscasting and somebody I met 30 years ago at ESPN. And what's the one thing you do not want in the middle of the Shohei Ohtani jazz and March Madness and the new thing in the NBA with the guy from the Raptors? What you don't want is a controversy over sports gambling on ESPN. Reese Davis is doing a segment with the new face of wagering there named Erin Dolan, and she goes so overboard trying to get people to bet one way, and with ESPN's betting service, by the way, surprise, surprise, that Reese comes back with a joke about how over the top she is, but the joke is comparatively subtle, as is Reese. You know what, he says? Some would call this wagering, gambling. The way you've sold this, I think what it is a risk-free investment. That's the way to look at it. Now, Reese Davis is so straight-laced that it's genuinely tough to tell when he's kidding around. So the reaction was, oh, God, no. He just said a bet was a risk-free investment, like you couldn't lose. Reese later tweeted a clarification and an apology, but this is another one of the risks of sports gambling. Besides the whole, oh, yeah, now we have to ban you from basketball for life kind of thing. Jokes about gambling can't be funny because people who are gambling, at least some of them, are not necessarily in full control of their minds at that moment. By the way, two other ESPN talent, Dan Orlovsky and Mike Greenberg, they made a dinner bet, again mentioning ESPN's betting site, on Twitter X, same day. And I was flashed back to the day the guy in charge of SportsCenter in the 90s would not let me and Dan Patrick and the other fellas in an ESPN fantasy baseball league conduct our player draft at our desks because it was too close to the newsroom and it made him feel uncomfortable. We had to go do it in the cafeteria. I swear. The runners-up, worser, Jeff Yass and dishonest Jay Trump, So now we know what happened when Yas, who owns $33 billion worth of TikTok, met with Trump, and suddenly Trump went from having threatened to ban TikTok within 45 days to demanding that it not be banned. The deal to merge that holding company with Trump's Truth Social disaster site and at minimum get him out from under the financial sword of Damocles it represents. The biggest institutional investor in that holding company that's going to merge with Truth Social is Susquehanna International, which was co-founded by Jeff Yas. Always good to keep track of what Trump has been bought with this time. But our winner, the worst, Charlie Kirk. When last we heard from Balloonhead, he was calling for live televised pay-per-view executions of those trying to bring Trump to justice and forcing kids to watch the executions. Now, he wants rubber bullets, whips, and machine guns at the border. Quote, at what point is it time to start to at least use rubber bullets or use some sort of tear gas to prevent this and quell this invasion? At what point do we use real force? Why do we have a military? Why do we have men with guns if we can't use them? Of course you should be able to use whips against foreigners. See, I don't know. My thought is, apart from this being a country made up as a haven for people in trouble who are fleeing other lands, apart from the fact that everybody here is the descendant of an immigrant, apart from that, maybe we should never resort to more force at the border than we used when Charlie Kirk's friends, many of whom got there thanks to his Turning Point USA, attacked the Capitol on January 6th. Or we shouldn't use more force than we plan to use when they try it again next fall and winter. Whips, rubber bullets, military with guns. And as to Charlie, and if you see him, you're going to need an elephant tranquilizer gun to bring him down with that gigantic inflated bean of his, Kirk. He is today's worst person, if he's a person, in the world!
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
This episode is brought to you by Terminix. Terminix can't help you run for office or take on the country's biggest problems, but they can help you solve one of the peskiest problems at home, pests. You know, the ants in your kitchen, the roaches under your sink, even the termites in the walls. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. No matter what type of pest it is, they can Terminix it fast with personalized pest care that puts you in control. Their expertly trained technicians may not know intricate political strategy, but they know their local pest pressures. And with customized plans tailored to your specific situation, you get everything you need to not just get pests out, but keep them out for good. Between their speedy service, caring technicians, and over 95 years of experience, it's no mystery why they're trusted by homes and businesses everywhere. So if you have a pest problem, don't stress it, Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TerminiX.com to book online today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
And now to the number one story on this all-new edition of Countdown and things I promised not to tell. And in the wake of the Ronna McDaniel train wreck at MSNBC and NBC News, well, train wrecks, how could the number one story not be this? Long before MSNBC staffers forced their network's chief to guarantee them they would never have to put Ronna McDaniel on their shows, there were at least six incidents in which on-air talent at MSNBC stood up and said no, and no it was. These were not always good things, but they underscore a reality. Management cannot get away with everything, and it is often incumbent upon talent to make sure that is the case. I'll get through the two times I threatened to quit as quickly as I can. I got back to MSNBC in 2003 as NBC tried to swing MSNBC to the hard right, right of Fox. It put on the disgusting radio host Michael Savage, gave him a weekend show that was an audition for a weeknight show. And of course, he couldn't resist telling a caller he was a sodomite and should get AIDS, and they got fired. But before that, they had guaranteed me upon my return that the one thing that would never appear in Countdown was a Michael Savage segment. Sure enough, one day, just weeks into the show, I come in and there in the rundown of my show, page like C11 or something, Michael Savage commentary. 3 minutes. Within moments, the executive producer of the show came in and said the Savage commentary was running whether I liked it or not, and that the executive who had guaranteed to me that this would never happen, Phil Griffin, was traveling, so I couldn't complain to him, and that was it. And he left. So I called my agent, and I said to her very calmly, I have no choice here. I got to quit, right? And she said, and she had just spent 7 weeks negotiating the new contract by which I returned to the place I had left 5 years earlier. She said, yeah, you have to quit immediately, but call Phil first. And I called Phil's office, and just as the executive producer said, he was not there. So I told his assistant, well, I don't want to dump this problem on you, but you should find him so he can decide who's doing Countdown tonight, because if there's a Michael Savage commentary running in it, I'm not doing Countdown tonight. In fact, this is the sound of me calling a cab right now. Amazingly enough, Phil Griffin called 5 minutes later and said, okay, we won't run it. We won't run it. But you got to find me some non-political reason to not run it. So I went along with his little game, and I looked at the commentary, and the guy was dressed head to toe in brown, and he kept repeating himself. And I called Phil, and he told him that, and Phil said, oh, good enough. We'll just put it in Scarborough's show. The other one I've told many times. It's early 2008 now, 5 years later, and I'm trying to get them to let me have somebody that Phil Griffin had fired, Rachel Maddow, guest host Countdown. I have gotten them to the point where they have told me they have hired her as an MSNBC contributor for $50,000 a year. For comparison, Ronna McDaniel got $300,000. Except one night I discovered they've lied to me. They have not hired her. She was still working for free. And that night was a primary night, and I looked down at our rundown of the primary coverage, Republicans and Democrats, and there's no Rachel. And I asked the executive producer who took over after I got the first executive producer fired, why not? And she says, well, Rachel ran out of cash. So when Larry King offered her $250 to go on his show tonight on CNN, she had to take it. I'm sorry. So now I have to call her and apologize and offer her all the cash in my wallet except the $5 I'm saving for the tip for the driver that night. And Rachel says, okay. And I literally hire her for MSNBC out of my own pocket for $437. And I call Phil Griffin and I say, you lied to me again. So now here's the deal. You get her the $50K you told me you gave her, and you make her a contributor. And if you don't, I'll be walking out in the middle of the primary coverage tonight, or maybe in the middle of my show tomorrow night. You'll never know when. Do you know how fast they can draw up a contract? Rachel had hers, I think, that night, at latest the next morning. The other small-ticket talent victory was on my behalf, but I had nothing to do with it. On the day NBC suspended me for making donations to three Democratic candidates in 2010 because that violated NBC News employee rules, even though they had drawn up a contract that specified several different times that I was not an NBC News employee and subject to none of the rules or the benefits of being an NBC News employee, and they wound up having to rescind the suspension and pay me anyway and having to negotiate a settlement with me because what they had done was breach my contract, which was ultimately why I left in 2011, that night, it went down, and in 4 hours, 250,000 people signed an online petition demanding my reinstatement. NBC asked Chris Hayes, who was then just getting started as my new fill-in and spin-off show candidate after Matto and Lawrence O'Donnell, they asked Chris to do Countdown, and he said, no. I've had my differences with Chris since then. But given that if he had a contract at that point, it could not have been for more than the $50,000 they sort of gave Rachel 3 years earlier, saying no was ballsy, courageous, and principled. Again, standing up to management, however, is not necessarily a weapon that can only be used by the righteous. At the height of the Ronna McDaniel thing, I saw Steve Schmidt ask rhetorically, what would Tom Brokaw have done? And the answer would have been, he would have done whatever was best for Tom Brokaw. In August 2008, there was a story coming out of the NBC News management end of the third floor at 30 Rock that a Republican goon with extra chins named Ed Gillespie had been in there with Phil Griffin and the president of NBC News, Steve Kappas, trying to get me silenced or fired or off the convention coverage or something. They didn't like Chris Matthews, but it was me they wanted fired. And the story was that somebody prominent from NBC News was in there with Gillespie or was invoked by Gillespie. The rumor mill was not certain. And then on September 5th, I found out. Without as much as a meeting, NBC ordered me and Chris Matthews off the coverage of the upcoming presidential debates between McCain and Obama. Within 12 hours, my agent had the complete story, and with it, the identity of which prominent NBC news guy had been in there with the Republican Party hack. Within 3 weeks, that NBC news guy was boasting about being in there. On September 29th, a lengthy and glowing profile appeared in the New York Times of Tom Brokaw. Quote, Mr. Brokaw said that over the summer he had advocated within the executive suite of NBC News to modify the anchor duties of the MSNBC hosts Keith Olbermann and Chris Matthews on election night and on nights when there were presidential debates. Unquote. This was especially odd because twice during the primary season, Brokaw had sent me emails that were so flattering that I printed them out, cut them up, and stuck them in my wallet about how well I had balanced the commentary part of my job with the anchoring primary night part of my job. Well, that all changed after Tim Russert died and suddenly Tom Brokaw was to be the moderator of the NBC debate in the debate cycle of the 2008 presidential election. To resume from this Times piece, this is how we all found out what Brokaw did. He boasted about it. Quote, Mr. Brokaw said he had also conducted some shuttle diplomacy in recent weeks between NBC and the McCain campaign. His mission, he said, was to assure the candidate's aides that despite some negative on-air commentary by Mr. Olbermann in particular, Mr. McCain could still get a fair shake from NBC News. Mr. Brokaw said he had been told by a senior McCain aide, whom he did not name, it was Ed Gillespie, that the campaign had been reluctant to accept an NBC representative as one of the moderators of the three presidential debates until his name was invoked. One of the things I was told by this person was that they were so irritated. They said if it's an NBC moderator for any of these debates, we won't go, Mr. Brokaw said. My name came up and they said, oh, hell, we have to do it because it's going to be Brokaw. This is not me quoting Tom Brokaw. This is the New York Times quoting Tom Brokaw. And in one part of this, it's Tom Brokaw quoting Tom Brokaw. Translation, the GOP said if Brokaw did not get me and Matthews bounced from the MSNBC coverage of all the debates, John McCain would not show up for Brokaw's debate. So Brokaw went in and blackmailed his own bosses. Okay, so now back to a righteous bit of talent power at MSNBC. The next June 2009, Fox put huge pressure on MSNBC and NBC News and the parent corporation GE and NBC's network, and especially the chairman of GE, Jeff Immelt. The goal was to silence my on-air stories about Fox and especially about Bill O'Reilly. The wild card here was this chairman, Jeff Immelt, his mother was a fan of Bill O'Reilly's, watched the show nightly, and she heard all the stuff about her son and GE, so she called him up and yelled at him. So the chairman of the sixth largest corporation in the world had to do something so his 90-something mother would not yell at him again. All of us were hastily summoned that day to Jeff Zucker's office. He was president of NBC at that point. He told us that Immelt had told him that if there were any more anti-Fox stories on MSNBC, he, Immelt, would simply shut the network off and fire everybody. I thought about all the money they'd have to pay me and all the work I wouldn't have to do and thought for a second, hey, that's a great idea, and then I thought better of it. Zucker asked me what to do, and I said, well, I don't know about long term here, but I would suggest that for a while, like a few weeks maybe, we say shouldn't do any anti-Fox stories until we figure out how we can do it safely. Zucker looked at me and nodded. He pointed at Phil Griffin and my producer and me, and he said, you and I will talk tonight or tomorrow, and we'll all meet again next week. Until then, nothing about Fox. Are we clear? Nothing. Silence. There were the assorted noises of people rising, producers for Hardball and Rachel's show and my show and Ed Schultz's show and some of the daytime shows. And I was almost at the door of Zucker's office, which was an office so big that it was, to steal the line from the great Ring Lardner, the size of the Yale Bowl only with lamps. And then a voice spoke up quietly but firmly in the silence. Excuse me, it was Rachel Maddow. Excuse me, I will not have the content of my show dictated by any corporations, including the one I work for. Now remember, this is June 2009. She's only been on the air like 10 months, and she still felt that way then. And especially a corporation I don't work for. I'll walk out first. I cannot have the audience wondering what else I have not told them. I don't do a lot about Fox on my show, but if there's a story about Fox, I will not honor this freeze. I will report that story, and if I am prevented from doing so, I will leave this place. Whereupon she left that place. Just the room. When she was gone, Jeff Zucker exploded at me. I told you she was a mistake. You didn't listen to me. I told you. Now she's your problem. All this is your problem. Get her back on the reservation or else. I said a few kind words about Jeff Immelt's mother, who was really running the network, apparently. And they separated us. And then in the elevator, my producer said, what are you going to do about Rachel? And I said, the F if I know. I said I did have an idea. I said the only person she was talking to in there was herself. This was not some sort of brand new surprise for her anymore. The show was successful. She was successful. She said she was a dancing cell phone outside a cell phone store once. She's not going back to that voluntarily. So I went in to talk to Rachel about an hour later, and I reassured her. I said, just give me as much time as the French government took before fleeing during the Nazi advance in 1940. I said, give me, what was it, 33 days? Give me 33 days. If we aren't back where we were this morning, we can both quit live on the air together. Or I'll quit, they'll start your show early, and then you can quit. That'd be fun, huh? 3 nights later, well after midnight on a Friday, my NBC issue BlackBerry buzzed with a quick email from Rachel Maddow. Hey, she wrote, don't necessarily quote me because I'm really drunk, but just make the best deal you can for us. I trust you. We don't need to do Fox all the time. I never do Fox stories anyway. I just had to say that in the meeting. And this is the best platform we'll ever have. Eventually, between Rachel being the bad cop and me being the good cop, and I know you're not used to me in that role, we overrode the ban on criticizing Fox. Sadly, the master of threatening management at NBC does not do it for good or for fairness. He does it for himself. Joey Scars. Joe Scarborough. You know who he is? He's the conservative turned liberal at the moment. Maybe. Because Trump wouldn't take him as his vice president in 2016. But I'm sure this is the way he really feels at the moment. early in January 2010, the Republican candidate to fill the Senate seat of the late Senator Ted Kennedy, Scott Brown, literally a former nude model, was at a rally when one of his supporters talked about, quote, shoving a curling iron up the backside of the Democratic candidate he was running against, Martha Coakley. Scott Brown clearly heard the remark and he responded, quote, we could do that. So on January 18th on Countdown, I did a brief commentary about how unsuitable Brown was for public office, and this was another example of it. I said he was, quoting, an irresponsible, homophobic, racist, reactionary, ex-nude model, teabagging supporter of violence against women and against politicians with whom he disagrees, unquote. I followed that with quotes from Brown and videotape of him disparaging his minority opponent in a local election to her face at a debate some years earlier to back up my point of view. 1 hour later, Joe Scarborough did a tweet storm about me. Quote, Olbermann calls Brown a homophobic, racist reactionary who supports violence against women. How reckless and how sad. Joe left out how true. It is no longer enough to simply disagree with someone. Just as when Beck called the president racist, this sort of rhetorical extremism must be discouraged. It cheapens the debate, end quote. As we all know, if anybody is an expert on cheapening the debate, it's Joe effing Scarborough. But back to the point of this. There was a standing rule at MSNBC. If you want to criticize another MSNBC personality, go ahead. Have a blast. But it can only be done on the air, on MSNBC, and that other person must have an opportunity to reply in real time, same show, or in some face-to-face way, no hit and run, no tweet storms. If you criticize them by name or by inference in any other medium, in a newspaper interview, on radio, on social media, you were to receive an automatic suspension. The only question was, how long? So the next day, the 19th of January, I called the now president of MSNBC, Phil Backbone of Jelly Griffin, and I asked him how long Scarborough's suspension was going to be. He asked me to come into his office. He said he'd already had a meeting about the tweets that morning with Scarborough's executive producer, Chris Licht. Remember Chris Licht? Griffin explained that Scarborough considered Scott Brown a friend. More importantly, Licht had warned Griffin that if Griffin followed through and enforced the suspension rule, Scarborough would have no other option than to go to the media and tell reporters, especially reporters at right-wing websites like Tucker Carlson's The Daily Caller, to tell them that he had been suspended because he was a conservative and I was a liberal. Not that it was the rules, but because he was a conservative and I was a liberal and I and not Phil Griffin actually ran MSNBC.
What can I do?
Griffin was scared, really scared. I told him this was his big chance. He could fire Scarborough and Licht. They'd just gone in to blackmail him. Eventually, he was going to have to fire them anyway. But I also said, I know you're not going to do that, and I know you're not going to suspend Scarborough either. And he didn't, despite the rule. But Griffin did send out a strongly worded memo to the entire company insisting that anybody who criticized another MSNBC show or host in another medium would be suspended from now on. Except Scarborough, who had just done exactly that and threatened his employers. Weeks later, just before my birthday, in fact, Brian Stelter's old blog TV Newser got a copy of Griffin's memo. I didn't send it to him. They wondered why Scarborough had not been suspended since he'd done exactly what was described in the memo. So they called the MSNBC president, and then they printed, quote, Griffin responds to TV Newser, quote, an important rule was broken. I spoke to Keith, and he said, in the spirit of teamwork and the free flow of ideas, he didn't think it warranted punishment or suspension. Now, when have I ever been accused of the spirit of teamwork? Quote, I also talked to Joe, and he apologized to me. That's why I made the decision that this didn't rise to the level of punishment, but I felt it was necessary to reiterate my long-standing policy. 100% bullcrap. Total fabrication. Licht and Scarborough had blackmailed their own boss, with a threat to smear them and me to Tucker Carlson, who we had fired 2 years earlier, into the right-wing echo chamber. They all should have been fired on the spot, Griffin included. Emboldened by that win about 3 months later, Scarborough said something on the air about a Democrat getting away with not being investigated for something, which is what his show used to be 100% of the time until Trump turned him down. It was Marcos Melitzis, the editor of the Daily Kos website, not just a regular contributor to Countdown, but somebody who had been promoting the MSNBC brand and my show and Rachel on that website for 5 years. Marcos sent a snarky but legitimate tweet questioning Scarborough's credentials to criticize others who were not investigated. Marcos invoked the staffer who died in an accident in Joe's office. Scarborough went nuts. He attacked Melitzis on Twitter. He inaccurately claimed Melitzis had accused him of murder. And a few days later, I got a phone call from Phil Griffin. He told me, Chris Licht has been in to see me. Remember Chris Licht? Joe won't put up with having Marcos Melitzis on his network anymore. Not only that, but Lick says many of Joe's friends, who also appear in Dayside and Primetime, won't come on if Marcos Melitzis is permitted to continue here. Chris is insisting Marcos must be banned from MSNBC immediately. Chris says he's afraid that if we don't do that, Joe won't come into work tomorrow. I laughed. I said, hallelujah. I congratulated Phil Griffin on the clear win-win. Griffin was not a very good executive, except in terms of preserving his paycheck. He was very bad at enforcing MSNBC's rules, but very good at creating new rules on the spot in order to protect Joe Scarborough and Chris Licht's friends, and most importantly, Phil Griffin. I'm banning Melitzis from any further appearances on MSNBC. I said, Phil, he's a contributor to my show. You're suspending my guest, who has driven hundreds of thousands of viewers to this show, to MSNBC, and I don't have any say in it? Joe Scarborough and Chris Licht own you, buddy. What you now have to worry about is whether or not I go tell this story on the air tonight or I wait and I tell it later. Phil, scared again, got a little conciliatory, and he said, it could be just a suspension if I cooperated. I didn't really feel like cooperating. I'd known Phil Griffin since 1981, and my desire to cooperate with him ended about 1981. But I thought, I'll leave this to Marcos. I told him, and he said he enjoyed his contributions to Countdown. He also did occasional appearances on the old Ed Schultz show. He said if there were a chance at resuming them, he'd prefer to at least try that. So Phil Griffin suspended Marcos Melitzis, and to my knowledge, that's 2010, and he has not been on MSNBC since. The suspension has lasted longer than the network had to that point. So that one, obviously, is one where the wrong guy stood up and threatened MSNBC and NBC News. Scarborough and Licht prevailed. They did similar things again and again, and after I left, again and again and again and again. Licht was eventually mistaken because of this for some sort of responsible adult producer, and he became president of CNN and screwed that place up so much that a year after he was fired, it still got into a bidding war with NBC for Ronna McDaniel. And instead of saying, you know what, if Scarborough's not suspended, if Marcos is not on the air tonight, I'm walking. I just said, you know, I have a torn rotator cuff. That makes being Justice with his shining sword all the time really painful. I mean, I've done it 20 times already this month. This time, I'll just take the money and I'll go, which I did a year later. Sorry. But this should serve, all of these stories should serve as reminders to everybody in similar positions. Ronna McDaniel. You can do it at least once. I've done all the damage I can do here. Thank you for listening. Countdown musical directors Brian Ray and John Philip Chenail arranged, produced, and performed most of our music. Seriously, Jeff Immelt's mother, 90, 93, 94 years old. When we resolved all this, when I got the right to criticize Fox back, we had a big dinner, the two of us and Zucker, in the executive dining room atop 30 Rock. And I said to him, "How old is your mother?" He said 93 or whatever he answered. And I said, why don't you just send some guys in there to pull the cable out of the wall so she can't watch Bill O'Reilly's show?" Well, he did not respond well to that. And I said, I understand that's stupid and ridiculous and offensive. That's what it's like to us when you say you'd rather take MSNBC off the air than find a solution to this. Well, he listened to that. Mr. Ray was on the guitars, bass, and drums, and Mr. Chanel handled orchestration and keyboards, produced by TKO Brothers. I think this cemented in his mind the idea that he was going to sell NBC. Unfortunately, he sold him to Comcast. More pillows of jello. Anywho, other music, including some of the Beethoven compositions, were arranged and performed by No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Our satirical and pithy musical comments are by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today was my friend Larry David. Everything else was pretty much my fault.
Sonny, why are you sending improvised explosive devices to Iran to kill Americans?
That's Countdown for this, the 225th day until the 2024 presidential election, the 1,176th day since Dementia J. Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Use the 14th Amendment and the not regularly given elector objection option provided by the Supreme Court. Use the Insurrection Act. Use the justice system. Use the mental health system to stop him from doing it again while we still can. A final addendum on this one topic. As I say to everybody starting in the media business, one thing to remember, there are no adults. The next scheduled countdown is tomorrow. Bulletins is the news warrants. Till then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. If your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.